Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a panel discussion which followed a special screening of the 2015 documentary film The Hunting Ground, directed by Kirby Dick. This program, presented in collaboration with the Women's Center for Advancement, formerly the Young Women's Christian Association, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday evening, April 20th, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The members of the panel will be Allison Taylor, Executive Director of the Office of Equity and Inclusion at Creighton University, Julie Medina, an attorney with the Douglas County Attorney's Office Domestic Violence Unit, and Jesse Hitchens, the Director of the Sexuality and Gender Resource Center at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The moderator will be Elizabeth Power, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Women's Center for Advancement. The Hunting Ground, from the makers of The Invisible War, is a startling exposé of rape crimes on U.S. college campuses, their institutional cover-ups, and the devastating toll they take on students and their families. The Hunting Ground follows survivors as they pursue their education while fighting for justice, despite harsh, and in many cases vicious retaliation, harassment, and pushback at every level. The documentary shows the prevalence of sexual assault at bastions of higher learning and of the powerful interests that re-victimize vulnerable students while shielding perpetrators. Some of the institutions mentioned are the University of North Carolina, Harvard, Notre Dame, the University of Tulsa, and Florida State University. Using first-person interviews and expert insights, The Hunting Ground delivers a devastating indictment of campus rape culture. In raw and emotional interviews, rape survivors and their families uncover an alarming effort on the part of universities and colleges to downplay and deny sexual assaults on their campuses, to keep crime statistics low and public approval high in an effort to protect their financial income. Especially devastating is the case described in the film of Erica Kinsman, who, while a student at Florida State University, reported that a student named Jameis Winston had raped her. After reporting the crime, she found out that Winston was a star member of the Florida State football team and a top contender for the Heisman Trophy. Ms. Kinsman also told of how members of the Florida State administration asked her to reconsider charging Winston, since such accusations against him could, quote, ruin his life and destroy his chances. At this point, 3 years later, she has filed a civil lawsuit against Winston, charging, quote, sexual battery, assault, false imprisonment, and intentional infliction of emotional distress arising out of forcible rape that she says happened early on the morning of December 7th, 2012. Here now to introduce the panel is our moderator, Elizabeth Power.
I want to once again thank you again. I know what we just watched was impactful and emotional, and it's probably going to take you a couple minutes to really figure out what just happened, which is good because our panelists are going to introduce themselves in that time. And I'm going to ask each one, they'll have about 5 minutes to introduce themselves and then also just give a quick reaction to the film overall. So, Julie, will you take us away, please?
Oh, sure, I get to start. First, thanks all for coming. This was an incredibly important film, and my name is Julie Medina. I'm a deputy county attorney here in Douglas County, and basically what that means is I'm a prosecutor, but I'm a specific prosecutor. I only prosecute crimes of domestic violence and sexual assault and stalking, and that's all I've been doing for 8 years. The reason I do that is I'm a rape survivor, 17 years, and so feel free to ask me questions, either job-related or victim-related. I am one of the individuals who has never been quiet about my own experience. I was originally from Illinois. I was raped by my boss. And trust me when I tell you, this film hit me because I was raped by a boss who'd been there for 25 years, who was with the company for 25 years by a billion-dollar corporation. And I faced much of what these individuals faced in this film as far as nobody believing me, not being able to get anywhere, being followed, having detectives on me, being eventually fired from my position. So if you think it doesn't happen, it does. And it's unfortunate it's happening on college campuses. I didn't file Title IX for employment. It's a Title VII, but I did the exact same thing that these young ladies have done. And once I found my voice, I just didn't stop talking, and nobody can usually shut me up about this subject. It's a it's a powerful thing, and to actually watch this film and see what these individuals are up against was just incredible to me. But if for me, there's hope in that, and in that ending, to see the impact that one voice, I mean, look at the impact that one or two voices had on this issue and this film, and now we're all here talking about it. And so my big thing has always been about education and talking about it, because if you stay silent, it's going to continue, as you see. So I have too much to say and so much to say that I don't know how what else to say, but I look forward to your questions. Like I said, I'm very open about my own experience and also what I do as a county attorney, so feel free to ask any questions about that.
Great. Thank you, Julie. So my name's Allison Taylor, and I work over at Creighton University. So I'm the executive director for our Office of Equity and Inclusion, which also means that I am our campus Title IX coordinator. So definitely this film, I think, initial reactions is wow. And some of the things that came out of those administrators' mouths just shocked me. It's more for me, like, I can't believe that that was the reaction that some of those people had. And for those students to walk away feeling like nobody cares about me was really upsetting to hear. And I think that just from seeing that, I think it's giving me that message of hope that there's all those students out there who are saying, hey, this isn't okay with us. And we went ahead and our school didn't help us, but we found a way to file Title IX legislation against them. And now, look, they are paying attention to what's going on. And helping those students across the country, I thought that road trip was just amazing. They're getting in their car and they're going to other schools, and that was kind of a neat journey to see. But I know that it's something that definitely hits home for people who work on a college campus, because I think that the first message when they're saying, you know, in those years of 2012 to 2014, the schools that were reporting zero sexual assaults on their campus, it's very telling. And I always say, if you're reporting zero sexual assaults, that's the worrisome factor. And it's, you know, it's taken years for a lot of people to convince their administration, it's better that we report a few, because if we're reporting zero, that's not true. And we all know that's not true. And I wouldn't trust those numbers either. So it's just, it's really interesting to just see how it's evolved. And even the end, it was, you know, 2015, and they're showing, you know, things that are happening with, I mean, the Jameis Winston case alone is just still shocking. And we have a long way to go, but it was a great movie. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jesse Hitchens. I am the Gender and Sexuality Resource Center Director at UNO, founding director, just got hired in February. And thank you, Film Streams. Thank you to the panel. This is, I really wanted to see this film personally, and so I was really excited that it was going to be in the community, as well as we were going to have an opportunity to have a discussion afterwards. Initial reactions, not surprised one bit, unfortunately. I just came from a large SEC school that, when I was there at the 5 years, we won 3 national championships, and I'm talking football more specifically. And that is exactly how athletics work. My office, I was in the Women's Resource Center. We knew that there were special advocates for the athletics program. If there was a sexual assault that we might have been called out on, and it wasn't that they didn't know it was an athlete involved, there would have been a quick turnaround to say, oh, no, we've got this. There's also the discussion in the Greek community, same thing, that there would always be CC'd on those emails if it wasn't directly to our advocates first. Because we were also on a grant outside of the university, we had the ability to not have to talk to the university for any reason, which was really nice. And because they were very much wanting us to report to them, saying, oh, because of Title IX, you all need to report. And the director was very clear about that's actually not the case, when we were confidential because of our status of providing counseling and advocacy within that space. So unfortunately, I can honestly say I lived that for 5 years, and that was really hard. And so that was an experience that I had at that space. What I can say, which is, I think is really hopeful, is that the administration there is changing, and I hope that that will help. Also, I'm here, and I can honestly say UNO is all the sense that I get from all the people there is not that, which is incredibly exciting because I can tell you how it feels to be on the other side of that. And if my director from my previous institution was here, and she would be nodding her head because I'm constantly calling her and telling her all the wonderful things that UNO does. And she's like, I cannot believe it. I cannot believe it. So that's really exciting to say, to sit here tonight and tell you honestly, from my perspective, I know what the other side is. And UNO is very much, and they said, you know, the president or chancellor is trying to do the appropriate thing. I truly believe that UNO is trying to do the right thing and get their ducks in a row to work on this issue effectively.
Thank you so much. I would like to open it to the audience right now if anybody would like to share their initial reactions from the film as well.
Okay, my name is Liz, and I have a quick question because this makes me angry. I have three daughters, a senior, a junior, and a freshman in high school, and I'm supposed to be sending my daughter off to college next year. And the one question I have is, if you are raped and you go to the hospital, and I'm assuming the police are called, why do you have to have permission from the university, and why do they have to have a hearing? It doesn't involve the university. It was two people. So why is the university making those decisions?
I think the movie, that part was very confusing as well. And what I would say is, at least the case for Creighton, and I think for UNO as well, is that if they're going to the hospital and the police are called, absolutely, that's a police matter. But that student also has the right to file a claim at the university, too. So they don't have to be one or the other. They could do both. They could do neither. It's going to be their choice. The Jameis Winston one is fascinating to me because Florida State had every obligation to do an investigation into that the minute they learned about it. When the university was put on notice, per Title IX, they were supposed to investigate that. And they obviously waited 2 years, which you're not allowed to do. If someone's choosing to go to the hospital, absolutely the police are going to be called, but it's the victim's right whether or not they really talk to the police and what they want to share with the police. And what we see a lot of times on a college campus is a lot of our students don't talk to the police, or they're not in a space to talk to the police. They don't want to. And I think that's what makes it kind of tricky. And in some ways, reporting on campus, we see people sometimes more comfortable with that than talking to the police, or vice versa. Sometimes they go to the police first. It varies on the person, but it is something that they could do both. It's not one or the other.
And to kind of speak to that as well, correct, if someone goes to the hospital immediately, the police are called, and that's when our office gets involved. A lot of what the film focused on, and honestly, I go out and I speak to students, and I've done that for 8 years, and I'm originally from Illinois, and I used to talk to students there. And part of the problem is, and this film addresses it, if your daughter goes to the campus police first, then a lot of times that starts that investigation of, well, do you really want to go, and do you really want to talk to the police, and are you sure you want to talk to the police? And by that time, already the victim's blaming herself or himself. They're already in that mode of, gosh, I must have done something wrong, so then they're not going to report. Some campuses have now started mandate reporting, and we're really trying to push for that. In other words, if Allison gets something, someone discloses to them, they have to call the police. It's not like that. Unfortunately, on most campuses, the campus can keep it internal. Once it goes to the actual police, though, then there should be a police investigation. But like Allison said, then part of the problem is we can't go forward without victim cooperation. Sometimes they don't talk to the police. So what I've really been trying to push for just nationwide is that mandated reporting. Because if you go to the hospital has to call the police. They have to. So our argument is, why don't campus police? You know, should be the same thing. So as far as your daughters, I would say education, take them to this film, talk to them about, you know, ways to prevent, but more importantly, what to do if it happens. Because you heard from these young ladies, they just didn't know what to do. And I actually go out, I started a speak out program when I was at Creighton Law, to go out to universities, and I go out to high schools and I speak to students, and that's the first question I get. Well, I didn't know it was rape. I didn't know it was domestic violence. And so you'd be amazed that they don't even understand what it actually is. So that would be number one, I would say, too.
I would also add that one thing that's different on a college campus is that the perpetrator might be like they talked about in the film, continuously perpetrating on campus, right? Mm-hmm. And so as a good employee, I want to get those people off campus. Obviously, they did not, but I think that that's important. And so the reporting process should enact that process to get those people out of the classrooms, out of the residence halls, because I want to get them out of those spaces. And so that enacts a process. Now, there are particular people on campus that are responsible employees. So any employee at UNO has to report if they were talked to about this process. So if that was the first person that student went to, then that's the process will be enacted there. If a person on campus who is an employee finds out that something happened, it's their responsibility as well. But there are people on campus that students can talk to as well that are not required to talk to and let Title IX know. Myself and the other person in my office is two of those people. All of our counseling center folks are those people as well. So then that is the choice of the survivor to go through that process if they go to those people on campus. And I'm sure Creighton has those people on campus as well. But for me, I personally do not want those people on any campus. And so I think that that's the whole, and what's exciting, well, how it should work, is that there's a preponderance of evidence, and that's a lawyer terminology, so I'm going to throw it over to the lawyer for that. But essentially, it just needs to be showing that 51% is that, yes, this is what happened. So when they're talking about he said, she said, not really. So if the Title IX coordinator decides that, yes, this probably happened, then that person will be sanctioned, hopefully appropriately, off campus.
Did we have a question down here with the red sweater?
Hi, my name is Kaylin Franz. I went to undergrad at Creighton and then grad school at UNO, and actually through this film found out I was in the same sorority as the woman from Florida State University. So that was kind of, I don't know, just a weird connection that I found out through this right now and made me want to know. I have two questions. So first, I think as a college student, I was often maybe confused or misunderstood the role of campus police, thinking that campus police was like the real police. And so thinking that if you're going through that system and you're reporting through the campus police system, it's not the same. And so that I saw a lot of within the women in this film is they were expecting the same response from the campus police that they would be getting from the regular police. And on top of that, what can we do as concerned alumni and women and men and just people wanting to make a difference and make it so this doesn't happen to other people? One thing that kept striking me was how many women students went to women administrators and women faculty members and told these women what happened to them, and they were not trusted and they were not believed and made to feel like it was their fault. And that is something that bothered me so much about this film, because we as women should be supporting each other and should be believing each other. And I don't know what I'm wanting to say about, I just wanted to say that because that was very frustrating. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
I think that goes back to a very larger question of gender and sexism in our society, because we are told from, and I say we, as a cis woman growing up in the society, we're told to protect ourselves, right? And we're told to protect ourselves in other ways. And those women in the film who are administrators, yes, they should have been more responsible and responding appropriately. And they should have known those processes so much better, because that is their responsibility, right? But they're a victim of sexism as well, and that's why they were responding in the way they were doing it. I'm not saying that they are not at fault, because they completely are, but they are also a victim of a larger cultural problem, which is genderism and sexism in our society, and that is why they were asking those questions. And so I think that that's another concern that's coming out of the larger discussion of why this hasn't been talked about.
And I think, actually, to answer your question, I think, for one, about what can you do as a concerned alum, I think a lot of it is understand what's happening on your campus that you went to, and what those processes are, and what has the university done maybe even since you've left. Because I think a lot of schools have really changed the way that they respond to sexual assault. I know even within the last, 2-3 years at Creighton, we have a violence intervention and prevention center. So we have an advocacy center where you can get confidential advocacy. We do a lot more prevention programming. We have a dedicated office where we do a lot of these Title IX complaints. And I think it's just knowing that, wow, that's so different than maybe someone who graduated 2-3 years ago. It's good to see. And if your campus is evolving, that's a sign of progress. And I think to address your other point, too, about the confusion that people had with going to their campus police and not understanding that, there's a big difference depending on what campus you're on. Some schools have commissioned police forces, and some schools have private security. And those private security can often be assumed, if you call them public safety, campus security, whatever that is, they're not real police. And sometimes it's also understanding what the process is at your university. Because, for example, at Creighton, someone can go to public safety and report that, but I will tell you, public safety turns around. If that report's about a sexual assault, they call me. They send me the report. So it comes over to my office. So it doesn't mean that that's the wrong step, because they're starting somewhere. And again, as Jesse was saying, they're mandated reporters, so they're going to let us know, and we're going to look into that. So sometimes it's just start with who you know or who you trust, and it'll get to the right place. And I think if the school's doing it right, it will work that way.
Did we have another question right over here?
My name is Nicole Natz, and I'm a licensed counselor in UNO's Counseling Center. My question is more about the law enforcement side and reporting, so Julie and Elizabeth may be handling this. It's a two-part question. I have worked with students who have the courage to work with law enforcement and go through interviews with detectives, and they're not prepared for the kind of questions that they're going to be asked, because I understand that detectives have a job to look for holes in the story and see if it can be passed on to prosecution, and if it's a story that will hold water, as we would say, to move forward. I work with students who are deterred by detectives. It seems that's their perspective and how they're questioned. So my question is, how would advocates prepare a student or a survivor to handle those interviews and be prepared of what they're walking into and how to interpret that? And also, how to advise a student who has heard from a detective, because you didn't say, no, I can't do anything with this. Because this is where most women stop with taking the interview. Are you sure you want to go forward with this? So they're getting a lot of mixed messages, where they're part of that really small percentage of women who have the bravery to go forward with the interview, and then they're meeting more roadblocks. So how would you advise someone to prepare for walking into that interview, what to expect? And then how would you advise someone who's hit a roadblock with a detective saying, are you sure you want to go forward, or you didn't say no, so I can't do anything for you?
Hang on 1 second. Shelby, can you take the microphone down here to Sakura for me, please? She'll answer the advocate side. Julie, go ahead.
That's right. Thanks. those are great questions. And I get, obviously, the victim once something's been filed, but I have to prepare them for trial, so I kind of am answering your question looking at it that way. The detectives, when we have Project Harmony, and Project Harmony, number one, that's where I'd always recommend somebody to go to for an interview, because those are detectives who absolutely are trained in interviewing victims, so hopefully they will not go through that. Our road patrol should be, but unfortunately that doesn't always happen. So one of the first things you can let them know is, hey, look, here's the thing. It's their job to investigate, and they don't know you. They don't know him. They're getting your side of the story. So, of course, they're going to ask you the hard questions that you would be asked at trial, or that you would be asked by, the defense attorney at trial, which is, why were you doing this? Why were you? Why were you? Why were you? And I would prepare that person. I'm always a worst-case scenario type of person, and I actually will sit there with a victim prior to trial and cross-examine them. And I always tell them, you're going to be asked everything you didn't do right. You didn't call for help. You didn't fight. You were drinking. Why were you wearing this? And just know those questions are not about fault whatsoever. And I would just continue to reinforce to that victim, you survived. You did everything right. And every time you hear that question, just keep saying that to yourself, that you survived. You absolutely did everything right. But to let them know, that's what's going to happen. Because I think if you're exactly right, if they're not prepared, that is going to be shocking. It's horrible for the victim. It re-victimizes you 100% because you're already blaming yourself. So that reinforcement, that constant reinforcement of they have to ask these questions. It's not that they don't believe you. They're doing their job. It's not a personal thing. You did everything right prior to that, and then afterwards, I would be my suggestion for something like that.
Sakura, do you want to answer how WCA advocates will help prepare?
Absolutely. I think at our agency, as well as with other agencies in the area like Heartland Family Service, Catholic Charities, on both the Iowa and Omaha side, we have a very unique relationship, I think, with both law enforcement and prosecutors. And if we're lucky and the person is in a hospital reporting, we get called out and we can make that instant connection with a survivor right away, let them know what their rights are as a crime victim, which is very huge because it's a very lengthy process when it comes to investigating. So we can also be there and be that emotional support while keeping them informed of the criminal justice process. And to me, that is a vital lifeline, is having that advocate, because we can meet that emotional needs, whereas law enforcement, they're asking those tough questions. We can help prepare them before and after, and sometimes even during, just knowing that someone's there that believes them and supports them, and it's unconditional. And we'll meet them in the hospital. If they don't want to go there, but they come into our office, we'll call law enforcement to come to our office so they don't have to report in the home or, you know, at school or something like that, so we can give them the choice of where they want to make that report. We will work with the prosecutors and the law enforcement to make sure that what she or he is saying is being heard and that they're being validated. And it may not come from law enforcement, but I can guarantee you it will come from a victim's advocate. And we will work with the campuses. The military also has wonderful advocates that come out. And same thing, they provide a victim's advocate who's there to support them through that process. Because as you saw in the film, very, very overwhelming process. And all it takes is that first person to plant that seed of doubt. What were you doing? Why didn't you say no? Why didn't you fight back? Just that one person to plant that seed of doubt, and that can stop them moving forward. So I would just encourage anybody that's ever had experience or you know someone they disclosed to you, please connect them to a victim's advocate immediately for that support, and we will gladly walk that journey with you all the way.
And real quick, because I didn't answer one of your questions, which was, what if they're told you didn't say no and all that? Law enforcement are not legal experts. They're not attorneys. They have a right to contact our office to have us take a second look. I've actually had that happen before, and I've actually had a case come to me that I've never seen before, or our office has never been presented before, and then we'll go and look, and we may not be able to do anything about it, but they have that right to be heard. And so I don't want a victim to ever think that it has to stop at law enforcement. They definitely can call the county attorney's office. If it's a domestic related, there's domestic violence officer specific investigators or Project Harmony, and just let that voice be heard until they have an answer. And unfortunately, it could be an answer they don't want to hear, because we have that high burden when you're talking about a criminal charge. But certainly they have that right to have us look at it.
Thank you. Shelby, did we have a question over there?
Yes. So my name's Nancy, and I think my question's for you, Julie. Where does NU, NU would be our FSU, it would be the one with the big football program, where do they stand on this? And I think I understood you to say that some colleges have policies where they have to report the rape to the police. They don't have a choice.
Correct.
So do you happen to know in Nebraska which of our colleges have that policy and which don't?
Do you know?
Creighton was working on it. I don't. University of Nebraska Lincoln does not.
It's not a state law.
I don't believe it's a state law yet.
Wisconsin just passed a state law. Has any university chosen? Does Creighton have that policy in place where you, if you know about it or anybody knows about it, do they have to report to the Omaha police?
The only, so at Creighton, if we know that it's a sexual assault of a minor, so anyone who is under 19, we do call the police. Otherwise, we leave that up to the victim. And we let that be their choice. So with our advocacy center, we very much say these are all of your options, these are all of your rights, and we present it that you can report to the school, you can also report to the police, and if you want to report to the police, we will help you do it. We'll call them out to Creighton, we'll have them come to campus to take your statement, we can go there. We do have students take us up on that, so that's something that we'll assist with, but we don't call them for every report.
Thank you. Do we have a question over here?
Yes, I have a question. I noticed that there's a lot of money involved with squelching whatever it is that might have happened on campus of sexual assaults. Lots of money involved. So I can see where it would be to their advantage to squelch whatever they could. So I guess I want to know, is there any kind of a penalty for, I'm talking about colleges, mm-hmm. is there any kind of a penalty to the university? Like suppose they were, if someone is found guilty, like the ones that were found guilty much later, if they had a $250 million fine, I bet they would get on that. I mean,
exactly.
So is there any repercussions to the university? This is, I mean, probably has to be after the guy is found guilty. I'm not sure of all that. But if nothing ever happens to the university, then of course they're going to continue to shove it under the carpet. Well, that's a lot of money, those millions that are, especially in the football, in the athletic department.
And that's why the Title IX.
Why would somebody
so
with like
important.
Little old me or you be important enough?
That's
in
why the
case
Title
like
IX is
that.
Important because then you're getting the government involved or someone else involved that's outside the campus, and that's what I said in my case. I had to go that route and I had to sue. And the
but
sad thing is,
happened?
The media makes you think, you know, you're doing it for the money, and it's not. It's like I can't get this person, I can't get anyone else to listen to me. I didn't want a dime from this company. I just wanted somebody to hear me, and they paid. not what they should have, but I got to tell you, you're right. They changed their policies. They fired the next person that sexually harassed somebody. So I would like to see that, but I think Title IX is a very good resolution
but
for that because that could make
them. But is there some penalty to the university after?
Well, they would actually have to. The Title IX suit is to the university. They're the ones that have to pay the victim.
So it's like a lawsuit, and they pay.
Exactly.
What, $100,000 or something?
So,
or, I mean, it's
depends,
not $350
right?
million where it matters, is it?
So one of the penalties are, and no college has gotten this penalty yet, is all of their federal funding can be revoked. And I don't, it depends on, and so we're looking a lot at, you know, public institutions, so that's the ones that are responsible for, you know, making sure to follow everything, because private institutions are a little bit different, but they can get all of their public funds revoked, which for large public institutions may be significant, because even with the rollbacks of funding from the government, that's still, if you say all that funding is pulled, that would be a huge blow, and that would very much increase student tuition, all those types of things. You'd have flight of faculty because they wouldn't want to be at that institution anymore. So there'd be the initial repercussion of the government's sanctions, but then you would see a lot of repercussions that would happen internally that people would leave that institution, and then it would not become as prestigious. And that those things matter as well, too.
But I think to get at your point, what you're saying is, too, that no school's ever had their federal funding pulled,
right.
Which is true. And what I will say is that when we're talking about Title IX pulling federal funding, it does apply to private schools, too. So pretty much any school, and that's kind of hard to know, but any school who's getting any kind of federal assistance, so any school who has federal financial aid, that falls under Title IX. So we're talking about 99.9% of universities out there who this would apply for. And what they're looking at now is, you know, that is so extreme that people often don't think, okay, they're never going to pull our federal funding. But now what they're looking at is how else can we maybe hold people accountable? And what they're doing now is hey, let's look at your Cleary numbers. So whatever university has to report in your annual security report saying how many sexual assaults you've had, how many cases of domestic violence or stalking, and if you are found to underreport those numbers, maybe you miss something, you don't report that, you can be charged, I think it's like $35,000 per, and they want to raise that number because that, you know, once you start looking at it, you're thinking, well, that's not huge in the grand scheme, but you start getting charged for stuff like that, that'll make a dent. That's something that's small that they can do.
Shelby?
Hey, I was just wondering for Creighton and UNO, what kind of mandatory training public safety faculty or administrators have to go through when they're contacted by students about these kind of issues? And also if there's mandatory education for all college students about sexual assault and rape, specifically not just prevention for potential victims, but also rapists.
Allison, you want to start off?
I would love to. So the answer is yes, we do lots of mandatory training. So for our students, that's going to be, it's required for all incoming students. So that's freshmen, that is professional students, graduate students, anyone who's coming to the university for the first time has to do a mandatory orientation where we talk about what are the resources available to you, what are these definitions. So when we say sexual violence, stalking, sexual harassment, what does that mean? We talk about how to report that, what your mechanisms for that are. You can report on campus and off campus and give them all that information. It's something we have ongoing educational campaigns on campus, so when we're talking about prevention education. And then for faculty and staff, this really is something that is a little bit newer, and I'll tell you, it's not the easiest, but we're mandating that everyone who's that mandatory reporter has to do an online training. Everyone got a letter last summer saying, hey, you're a mandatory reporter because you're not confidential. This is what it means. You have this obligation to report. You must report. This is how you report. This is what you report. And we've seen reports skyrocket in some ways. It's not necessarily that we're getting all these huge incidents, but sometimes it's something as simple as, you know, this student talked to me about something and it didn't sit right, and I think I'm supposed to report this to you. And that's what we want to see, because in many ways, that's the lens that we have in my office of, okay, this is something that I do want to make sure we know about, and we can plug in our victim advocate and we can offer them resources. And it is a challenge, but it's something that we know we need to do, and it's important to do, and we're seeing that pay off.
Very similar to Creighton, what UNO is doing, but I'm actually going to punt that to the counselor who is in our at UNO to answer it further, just because I'm still a fairly new employee, and I don't know all the ins and outs, but we have an online program as well as some other things that Nicole is going to talk about.
Hello again. My name is Nicole Natz. I'm a counselor at UNO, and I'm also on Voices Against Violence, which is a task force at UNO. So in terms of students, they do a two-hour online training called Campus Connect about educating about what sexual assault, stalking, intimate partner violence is, and also how to do bystander intervention, and also learn about our resources on campus, which are extensive. And then with faculty and staff, that is a training that is currently being rolled out to all three or all four Nebraska campuses, so UNMC, UNK, UNL, and UNO. And that is an obligation that all faculty and staff have, is if they're not a confidential advisor, which all the counselors in the Counseling Center are, and then Jesse Hitchens and then her other staff member, they have to report to Charlotte Russell or Angela Nastasi, who are in our Title IX office, or Phil Covington or campus security. So that is something that is in the works and is taken very seriously. So any other? Did I answer your question?
Did we have a question, Nicole, behind, waiting?
Hi. I also am from UNO. I'm a faculty member. I'm Associate Director of Women's and Gender Studies. I'm really fine being one of the very few people of color in this room. But I've got students just today, for example, said, I don't talk to my other professors. I only talk to you. And I also went to Notre Dame, and I knew about that Lizzie Seberg case. And I don't want to say everybody knows about Jameis Winston, but I do like how they dealt with race in the film, because they showed a somewhat of a range. It was a binary of black, white, it seemed, but of both victims. And they talked about Jameis Winston, and then they had the guy who had his face muted out. But I think I would love to hear about what kind of outreach is being done so for people not like me who would go somewhere and report something to someone who didn't look like me. I mean, I've got colleagues who look just like me who won't go to the fish fry with me at Holy Name because she looked around and went, yeah, drinking white people, no, not so much. And she just took her fish and went. And another friend and I stayed, and she was also a black woman. So I'm just kind of wanting to throw that out there as far as, you know, what outreach is or could be done for reporting when you have all the history that we have in the country with race and gender and sexuality.
Well, we're a real white panel. I'm making the assumption here. So I don't know that for sure. There's also, I would say, just general assumptions about people's sexuality. I think that that's there too, right? And one of the notes that I did make about that, and Peggy, thank you for bringing it up, is so they talked about closed communities and power structures, right? They talked about fraternity, sorority life, Greek life, and they talked about athletics. But one of the things that is really significant and we need to take note of is closed communities in general. So you're talking about the structure of support around people of color and networks, LGBT folks and their networks, undocumented people and their networks, and international students, right? And so I think this goes back to one of the things that I try to do is make my connections into those communities strategically, and so that people know to talk to specific advocates in that community to get them to the right places, to get them to me or get them to the counseling center. Because I think that that's the best way to do that, because I'm not trustworthy, and I know that. And well, I mean, I am. I want to say that. But my face means something, and I know that. And there's politics behind that. My marriage status means something to people, and I know that. And so I'm very, very conscious of those positions of privilege that I negotiate. And so I really appreciate you bringing that up because, for example, this past week, a student was able to network in through the LGBT, I call it the underground network, right? Because that the director of the gender and sexual orientation agency knows and trusts me. A lot, that network was created, and so a student was able to get the resources that that person needed because of the fact that that student trusted me and knew that that I was a safe space and that I was going to get the resources. That was a LGBT person, that was a person of color, and so that was a really exciting moment that I hadn't. It's only been like a couple months, but that's how I negotiate that. But I think that's a really hard question to negotiate, right? And it's very something I try to be conscious of.
And I like the way that you said, obviously building some of those relationships and other advocates on campus who trust you and trust your office, because I think that goes a long way. I think that when you work on a campus, it's so important to do that outreach, and so that people know the work that you're doing and they can tell other students, you know, I have seen this process work, or this is what you can expect. And one of the features, you know, when we're talking about adjudicating this on a college campus is, you know, we have a very structured process. And part of that is that each person can bring a support person with them. And we have a really diverse pool of people who serve as those advocates and who can say to the students they work with, yeah, I've been through that process. This is what it looks like. You should believe in this because I've seen it work. And that goes a long way when you have faculty and staff who support it, because if they don't support what you're doing, oftentimes they'll tell the students that. They'll tell them, oh yeah, don't even report it. But when you have a good process, you see that increase because other people are saying to students, yes, I would encourage you to do this.
We have another.
Hey there. I'm curious. There's an assumption I probably have that no perpetrator, no rapist wakes up one morning and says, I'm going to rape somebody. There's a culture, there's things that breed this be it pornography and other things. And I'm just curious if you guys could comment on that.
You know,
we all look at Julie.
I know, because they know I'm going to go off on a rant. I wish I could answer that, and unfortunately I can. And one of the biggest things that hit me is where the young lady was like, why me? I can't. I've asked that. Actually, I didn't. I used to say, why not me? I don't know why rape is rape. I wish I did. There's different types. There's been psychological studies on why they do that. I just think personally that they cannot be rehabilitated. Just I've seen too many studies about that, whether it's they saw violence or whatever. All I know is there's no excuse for it. One thing that I do see, though, is that rape culture, and it is a word that I didn't even know about 4 or 5 years ago and has just become part of my life when I teach, because we live it. You saw it. You're right. There's things that perpetuate this. Part of the problem is that entitlement that I see in these types of crimes, that these individuals 100% think they are entitled to do this, that they think that it's okay, that they are in that community. You saw how quickly those fraternities change and they become that community, that it's okay because it's acceptable with all the frat brothers and things like that. So I do think that behavior can be perpetuated. I think it can be learned, and then I think it then can be accepted, and that's what you're seeing here. So my comment is we need to stop that rape culture because it's out of control, and if you think it's not, you just saw it. You saw it firsthand. And one of the ones I think that really hit me the most was that Steubenville, Ohio case. Tim Deckel's here. I ran it during his Violence in America class about that, because what hit me about that is, what did you see in the media? They didn't focus on the victim who had been raped and put all over YouTube. They focused on these poor, quote, poor young men whose lives are over. Mm-hmm. That victim's life is over forever. They'll never, ever, ever be the same. And so I think part of that thing is that we just need to have that education to say, this is not okay. You know, we were just having a conversation before this panel that we need to not just teach our young women about rape, but we need to teach our young boys not to rape. And that is one of the biggest things.
Did we have another question?
Yeah, we have time for one last question. Thanks, everyone, for their participation.
Hello, my name's Catherine. I have a sister who is going into high school and just thinking about doing college tours and things like that. Creighton and UNO, obviously you sound like you're doing great things, but like, what would be maybe kind of a list of questions that I could tell her or I could ask administrations going to college tours and that sort of thing? What's a good set of lists being like, what do you do about X, Y, and Z?
That is an excellent question.
Great way to end.
Yeah. What I would recommend is on going on those campus tours, I would talk to the tour guide and say, hey, if someone were to be sexually assaulted, where do they report that on campus? Where do you have advocacy on your campus? Where would someone go if they wanted to talk to an advocate? And I would honestly ask some of those questions to see, does the tour guide know? And if the tour guide can't answer that, then that's a question for me about how well educated are those students about what resources exist, because they should be able to at least at minimum say, oh yeah, it's that one office, you know, by the cafeteria, has that window with something. They should be able to at least recall something like that if they're doing good education. I think the other thing is too, asking about what kind of programming or prevention messaging or whatnot they're doing on campus. So, you know, did that tour guide have to do a mandatory training when they came in as a freshman? Did they have to see something in orientation? Do they have some kind of program that they at least know about on campus? And just asking some of those things, because I think if we're doing a good job, our students should at least have some knowledge about what we're doing.
Yes. I would also add, so kind of changing the conversation just a wee bit, and what is the sex positivity conversation that's happening on that campus? In the sense of, what is a healthy relationship? What does that look like? So you know what happened, you know what the resources are when, if, you know, something were to happen, but what are the resources that are available to support people who have a relationship? What does that look like? Are there free condoms on campus? That says a lot too, right? Of we know that people are having sex on our campus, and we want to encourage a healthy sexual relationship, and those types of things. Those things really do matter, and I think that how do they talk about healthy relationships on their campus, I think, is an also part of that discussion as well. But that she nailed that answer, so yes.
And one real quick thing is that conversation that you're going to have with them, 100%, so that they know there's somebody to go to, and that's you, that it's not their fault, that you don't expect something to happen, but if it does happen, this is what you do, and let them know. You report, you go get help, you call 911. For the love of God, you tell someone, because that's the number one thing. I always say that this is the most silent crime in the United States, and it's silent because we victim blame, and they have to know that they can come forward, that they don't have to be embarrassed. It's not their fault. That is the number one thing that you need to tell somebody, because if you instill that in your children, they're going to remember that, and then they're hopefully going to be able to go get those resources, and if not, they're at least going to tell somebody who will know what to do.
Thank you, ladies, so much. We're so appreciative of you taking time out of your day and being here.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. I'll echo the thanks. Also add thanks to Elizabeth and our wonderful partners at the WCA. Thank you all so much for coming to this important film. Please tell people to come see this film. It's so important. Thank you so much for being here.
You've been listening to a program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a panel discussion which followed a special screening of the 2015 documentary film, The Hunting Ground, directed by Kirby Dick. This program, presented in collaboration with the Women's Center for Advancement, formerly the Young Women's Christian Association, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday evening, April 20th, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The members of the panel were Allison Taylor, Executive Director of the Office of Equity and Inclusion at Creighton University; Julie Medina, an attorney with the Douglas County Attorney's Office Domestic Violence Unit; and Jesse Hitchens, the director of the Sexuality and Gender Resource Center at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The moderator was Elizabeth Power, director of marketing and public relations at the Women's Center for Advancement. Special thanks to Brooke Masick, Patrick Kinney, Caitlin McDermott, Shelby Sire, Molly Welch, and Jim Foyt of Film Streams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next special program at Film Streams will be tomorrow evening, October 27th at 7 o'clock. At that time, there will be a screening of A Borrowed Identity, co-sponsored by the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.